People First Radio is a program about people, the society in which we live, and issues related to health and wellness.
This is People First Radio. I'm Joe Pugh. Today on the program, we go into more detail on recently announced sober housing in Victoria. Plus, how a group in Cape Breton is treating society as the patient as they look to adapt the Icelandic prevention model. And the new Chanolf Youth Warrior Family Society share stories of success. Welcome to People First Radio. Publicly funded second stage sober housing is on its way to Victoria. A recently announced partnership between the province of BC, the city of Victoria, and Kool-Aid Society will see 20 units of recovery-oriented housing at a site on the city's Johnson Street. Intended for people who have completed early stage recovery, it's expected to open next March. I reached out to Kool-Aid Society, hoping to learn more about how the housing will work and what it took to get it announced.
Hi, everyone. My name is Angela Moran. I'm the Director of Housing and Shelters with the Victoria Kool-Aid Society in Victoria, BC.
And can you explain to me the model behind this new housing project that was announced in November?
Absolutely. We are so excited at Kool-Aid. We've identified this as a major gap in our housing continuum. So recovery housing or abstinence-based housing, sober living model, it's a model that has been in operation for decades in Canada, throughout North America. And it's really a social-based peer model that we will be operating here. It's going to be 20 units, all with individual kitchens and bathrooms. And well, there'll be two house leads. There's going to be 20 units in the building, two peer leads, and then a light touch staffing model. Kool-Aid's very versed in supportive housing and sheltering, but this, which has a heavy 24/7 staffing model, this will be a light touch because we're going to be working with people that are quite far along in their recovery journey. They've made that step to enter into a medical detox program. They've completed a 60 to 90 day recovery treatment program. And then upon exit, we'll be doing in-reach into these different facilities throughout Victoria and identifying people that have been either exiting supportive housing or without a fixed address to be coming into this housing. It will be for male and male identifying 19 plus. Within 6 months of the program, we really want people to be volunteering in community or working in community and really supporting them towards a pathway to independence. Kool-Aid's got a very broad spectrum of a housing continuum. So wherever people land after 6 months to 24 months in their recovery journey, we'll be supporting them to exit the program into the next stage of housing that they're ready for.
Could you tell me more about the intake process? So people are expected to have been sober for about 60 days, done a medical detox program. How are you going to line it up and maybe stick the landing with the timing on that?
Yeah, so this is sort of a new process for us as well. We're newer to the recovery space, but we have a really great partnership with the City of Victoria and BC Housing in this process. For supportive housing and shelters and rent supplements, there's a process called the Coordinated Access and Assessment Program, where we work in partnership with BC Housing for placements. So BC Housing is in partnership. We'll be developing a coordinated access process for this building, and we'll be working closely with recovery partners. There is a gap within the recovery-oriented system of care, not just in Victoria, for affordable recovery-oriented housing. And there's a lot of folks that are in shelter, in supportive housing. Maybe they have had an experience with corrections and they're exiting, say, a treatment program without a fixed address, but they're not able to afford the sober living housing that is available. Because it can be upwards between $1,500, $2,200 a month. This will be a flat rate of $500.
To your knowledge, is there anything in the Victoria area that operates on a similar model or is geared to people trying to experience sober living that is within that public housing sphere, or will this be the first one in the area?
There are so many community partners that are operating this model. In terms of having a partnership like this with BC Housing and an opportunity to maybe create a model that is more accessible, I'd say it is newer in terms of this approach. So we're really taking this opportunity with in our partnership with the City of Victoria and BC Housing to see if we can create a model that works. A lot of recovery houses throughout BC are funded through philanthropy dollars or through higher rents. So we're very, very excited to see. BC Housing is open to an iterative model that's going to work and be informed by the people that are participating in the program as well. And hopefully, out of the 3 years of this funding, we'll find something that is going to work that can be replicable throughout the community, throughout the province.
So it's a partnership between you, Kool-Aid, and the City of Victoria and the province via BC Housing. How did it come together? Whose idea was this?
When I started at Kool-Aid 2.5, almost 3 years ago now, I had quickly identified this as a major gap in our housing continuum. There's a lot of our clients within Kool-Aid Health and clients that live within our housing that had identified wanting to start their recovery journey, wanting to start treatment, but they can't come back to our, but they don't want to come back to our housing as it is, because we are offering housing for those that are in active addiction, for those that are starting their recovery journey, but it is housing that is lower barrier. So it's not necessarily one of the most critical stages of a recovery journey is that aftercare after treatment. And you are now tasked with finding new social circles, working towards independence, and having a community is a really important part of that. So we're excited that, you know, this is the new offering that we have at Kool-Aid. So in our strategic planning process in 2023, we heard loud and clear from the staff as well that this is something that we need to bring to Kool-Aid and really join the recovery partners in the region. And then we built a basic framework and started socializing the idea and the program to our funders. We have the benefit of quite a large housing stock at Kool-Aid, and one of our housing programs came to an end. And we thought this is our opportunity, this is our moment. So we really pushed with our funders. And then we were approached by the City of Victoria with their community and safety well-being plan and the big announcement that they had earlier this year. All the stars aligned. And that was where it was in August that we submitted that proposal. And over about 2 months, we were able to take it across the finish line.
People will often talk about addiction as a chronic relapsing condition. If someone is in the program, if someone is living in the housing and they experience a relapse, what will happen? What's the plan?
Yeah, relapse is part of recovery. I'm in agreement there. So we are going to be working on that process. If it's a one-time thing and they need to go back to treatment, right now we're working on pathways to get people in quickly if we can. We also have a spectrum of shelters at Kool-Aid, from higher barrier to low barrier, some where use is very, very little. So we might, we will likely have a process there that brings people to a place where they can get well, get back to a place where they can join the house again. But we understand that there is a journey of relapse with recovery. If behaviors are persistent and there's just kind of chronic non-adherence of the rules of the house, they will be asked to exit the program, but it usually takes quite a while to get there.
Earlier on, you suggested that this isn't intended to be the place someone comes and lives forever. Is there like a maximum time someone will be allowed to stay?
Yeah, it's 6 months to 2 years. And in that journey, if someone comes up to 2 years and they're really close, right, and they need a couple more months, of course, we're going to be flexible, but that's the general guidelines. Some people are going to come to the house quite far along in their recovery journey and may have touched this sheltering or supportive housing system a little bit and are able to kind of push through and work on their recovery goals, get back to work, have some good reconnection with family, and be able to get back into independent living quicker than others. Others are going to take a little bit more time. And then it might be a journey where from there they get connected with a rent supplement after 2 years into independent living. We also have a fairly large stock of what's called $500 shelter rate independent living units. So it would be, there are some of our participants that will likely be on some sort of assistance and maybe not be able to work for the rest of their lives, but they can volunteer in community. So independent market living is a major barrier to them. And we recognize that. So we do have options and opportunities within our housing stock and within Victoria with other nonprofit housing providers that are offering independent housing.
You're listening to People First Radio. I'm speaking with Angela Moran, Director of Housing and Shelters with the Victoria Kool-Aid Society. We're speaking about a new housing project they're opening in the spring designed for people in recovery. It's a partnership with the City of Victoria and BC Housing, and will have 20 spaces for men at a site on the city's Johnson Street. Is there anything you think people need to know about the state of the broader housing continuum in Victoria? You've talked off the top about how this in particular was something, was an area, sober second stage housing, if you will, was an area that was really missing from the continuum. Are there other pieces of that continuum that need more work, or there's something particularly notable about that people need to know?
I think that there's quite incredible work happening right now on all the different models of housing that are working or might be struggling. Complex care housing, the review is underway right now. I know there's a lot of really great people working to continue with the great work that's happening there. I do think there's a need for potentially more beds within that model. The supportive housing, Pathways Out, I'd say, it's not necessarily just recovery housing for Pathways Out. Pathways Out of supportive housing and having this $500 shelter rate, flat rate model of housing where the rent structure is geared that way is a major, major gap. A lot of our folks are on some sort of assistance and likely will be for the rest of their lives, but are ready for independent living, but are not in a position to afford market rate. So there's lots of work happening around rental assistance programs and higher rent supplement programs, but a lot of them are fully allocated in the system. So there's a bit of a gridlock right now within supportive housing and shelters. So we do see this 20 units as like a move in the right direction. We just need so many more of them.
Has there been a change in the approach of BC Housing such that it was more possible to get a program like this off the ground than in the past?
I think that with government, public sentiment typically precedes public policy, and we will likely see this trend continuing. I think without the support like we are getting from our municipal and provincial partners, we won't see recovery housing get the chance it needs. And I do think that it is the way forward. And it doesn't necessarily need to be just this sober living model. There's a lot of different kind of models that are happening right now. There's pockets of pilots happening throughout the province, and BC Housing is supporting different pockets of those pilots throughout. So I do think that there is a shift underway, and it might take some time, but we are very, very grateful for this opportunity and this partnership.
Could you tell me about the municipality's role in the partnership specifically, and maybe from the angle of if there are local politicians in other places who are advocating for this type of housing, who want to see it in their community, is there anything a municipality can do to make that more likely to happen?
Mm-hmm. I think that with the housing targets that were assigned to the different municipalities throughout the province, this is the City of Victoria's commitment to seeing positive pathways and egress. They've identified that with what they're seeing outside. The shelters are full every night and supportive housing is full. So they saw that this was a bit of a no-brainer and a real commitment. They haven't committed beyond the 3 years because really that is not necessarily their lane. right? But they saw this as an opportunity and a partnership to let's work together and see if we can create a model that we can keep seeing happen throughout the province. They've committed capital dollars. Right now, there was a program running for 20 years at Johnson Manor. So it had its regular maintenance upgrades, but we did see this as an opportunity to really kind of give it a bit of a reno. So right now there's a renovation underway. The City of Victoria committed some capital dollars to support that work along with the province, BC Housing. And then they've committed some staffing dollars throughout this. So it's a bit of a partnership in terms of BC Housing and City of Victoria funding the operating and the capital. And then the program will, we have 3 years to really create that model that's going to work.
Could you tell me more about what the building was being used for? Previously, you've mentioned there was a program that is ended. What is this housing effectively replacing?
So for 20 years, there was a forensics program happening. So those that were not held criminally responsible for the crimes that they committed, they would go through a treatment program on the mainland. And then when they were finished with that program, they'd be released into community, into a transitional program. So it was very kind of, I would say, not similar, but similar in terms of expectations of behavior on the site. There was no use, no substance use on the site. And they had to follow a fairly strict program that either they committed to or it was deemed by their medical professionals.
When something like that winds up, where have the people moved on to?
They were moved on to other programs that were very similar. There was other providers that were also providing that program. So we just slowly over a year moved people into the programs throughout the community that were already happening.
It's expected that this new housing will be online by the spring. You've mentioned that there are some renovations happening to the building until then. Do you have an opening date in mind? Is there anything more you can tell us about that?
Well, I've been in this game for about 12 years with many waiting on many buildings to open. I feel confident between March and April that we'll have an opening date. Let's say March 15th, but we're saying spring of 2026. We'll get an update from the contractor in January to see where we're at, and we'll be able to kind of commit to a bit more of a timeline at that point.
Is there anything else you think it's important to bring to the conversation, or anything you'd like to let the public know about this new housing or the model behind it or the process of getting it online?
I think what's important now is that I'll be hiring up the manager by January. We'll be really fleshing out and developing the access process, the in-reach process. So for housing providers that are out there, for outreach organizations that are out there, you'll be hearing a lot soon. I know that there's been a lot of chatter about how do I get people in? So I really want to commit to everybody that's listening, that is wondering and waiting to see how they can get people that are in need of this housing. We'll be sharing more information soon.
Angela Moran, thank you so much for taking the time to speak with me.
Thanks so much. Have a great day, Joe.
Angela Moran is Director of Housing and Shelters with the Victoria Kool-Aid Society.
This is People First Radio, coming to you on CHLY 101.7 FM in Nanaimo, on CFMH Local 107.3 FM in St. John, and on CFUV 101.9 FM in Victoria.
A group in Cape Breton is looking to take a page from Iceland to help prevent youth substance use. Undercurrent Youth Society in Glace Bay, Nova Scotia, is one of a number of organizations nationwide receiving federal funding to adapt something called the Icelandic Prevention Model to a local context. The model is all about a community-driven approach to preventing substance use and other negative outcomes for youth. Part of the model is identifying risk factors and strengthening protective factors in the community. Trevor Den Hartog is the executive director of Undercurrent Youth Society. I asked him what they're hoping to address by bringing the model to Cape Breton.
Oh boy, you know, I think if I had to boil it all down into one thing, and I And I think it's possible to do this. I think lack of opportunity is what we are actually, you know, if we had to boil it all down to one thing that we know we have to change in the environment, is that there is such limited opportunity for most of our population. I mean, we're very isolated, as you know, Cape Breton is an island, literally separated from the mainland of the rest of Canada by a little, you know, the causeway. And so that isolation breeds all kinds of positive things and then also negative things. All of those negative things really, I think, can be sort of narrowed down into lack of opportunity. And that lack of opportunity can be because of socioeconomic status. You know, there are a lot of poor folks here. In New Waterford, we're dealing with about somewhere between 39 and 41% child poverty rate. And in Glace Bay, we're dealing with around 37% child poverty rate. So already, the environment tells us that there's a huge lack of opportunity, because anything that you want to do costs money. And if you don't have money and you're already living in poverty, it's pretty tough to get yourself out of that cycle of poverty. So I think opportunity is probably the biggest. And so what we have already started talking about, and one of our core missions, even just as an undercurrent, is to be able to offer every opportunity to every child. And so that means barrier-free opportunities. So even just something as simple as, now we're not going to do this because there's already a very successful hockey league here in Glace Bay. But let's just say a whole bunch of kids can't afford to play hockey, and that's a barrier. And so if we want to address that barrier, then we need to make that hockey league accessible on an equity basis for all kids. And one way that Iceland has done that is something called a leisure card. And so every student between the ages of 8 and 18 get this leisure card that, let's say, has $500 on that leisure card. And that student can use that $500 toward any sport or leisure activity they would like. And so that's a way to bring equity and opportunity to the entire community. So every kid gets the exact same opportunity. They can choose then what to do with that, but that levels the playing field, as it were, I suppose. Now, I don't know if we're going to do that. It would be great if we could institute some sort of leisure card for every child in Cape Breton Regional Municipality. That would be amazing. I estimated that would cost between $4 and $5 million annually for us. And so that's a lot of cash. But that's the kind of thing that we're talking about, right? That we're, in order to bring equality and equity into the environment, those are the kinds of ways that you have to start to address it so that every child has the same opportunity.
Undercurrent is still early in the process of seeing how the Icelandic prevention model can look locally.
We are now at the stage where we're starting to adapt that model to our context. And so one of the first stages of that is to gather data.
So far, youth in the area have completed a survey that will help inform how the model takes shape.
There's about 60 or 65 questions on the survey that each of the students participate in. And the questions range from asking questions about their family and how much time they spend with their family, their interactions with substances, alcohol, vaping, what they do in their spare time with their peer groups, their interactions with schools and school officials and peers in the school setting. It sort of runs the gamut. We get a real picture of each student's view on sort of the four domains that we concentrate on, which are peers, the school environment, leisure time, and family. So the questions are pretty direct, and their responses should give us a pretty clear picture of sort of where they're at, what the baseline is right now for students here in Cape Breton.
Den Hartog says youth will be involved in creating the programs intended to help them.
I think something that's really important to note is that youth voices will be centered in the design of these interventions as well. Again, it's not just a bunch of adults sitting around a table with good ideas. It's taking the data, it's disseminating that data and sharing that at multiple levels of community. One of those will be, we are also developing something that we are calling a youth congress. And that youth congress, over the next couple of years as we develop it, will function as a sort of a wing of our municipal governance. We have been given the thumbs up by our mayor and council to pursue this as something that would be then implemented as a regular part of the discussions around things that have to do with our youth. So rather than just adults making decisions for our youth being involved in the conversations and design of not just the interventions, but even in decision-making processes over, you know, municipal policies that have to do with alcohol and all of those kinds of things. So youth voices are going to be centered as well.
He says the model is about creating opportunity.
For us, it's not about eliminating the risk factors. It's about increasing the protective factors. And so we want more positivity. We want more opportunity. We want more arts. We want more culture. We want more recreation, more family time, all of those kinds of things. So it's not about concentrating on the negative. It's about really identifying how we can really bolster the protective factors that are already existing here in our community.
This is People First Radio. In Cape Breton, Undercurrent Youth Society is working to adapt a model from Iceland to help improve the lives of local youth. The Icelandic prevention model focuses on identifying risk and protective factors and treating all of society as a kind of patient rather than youth specifically. Trevor Den Hartog, executive director of Undercurrent, spoke about some of the risk and protective factors his team have identified in their community thus far.
I would say that probably the most surprising protective factor that we found was the passion, love, and acceptance in our community. Our community is, Cape Bretoners are the kindest people you could possibly meet. And as an outsider moving here from, you know, the hustle and bustle of southwestern Ontario to a much slower pace of life, and people here are just so kind and forgiving and loving and supportive, no matter what sort of stage of the socioeconomic, you know, condition they're from, everybody is just so kind. And so I think for me, the most surprising thing was to have that identified by all three advisory groups, that they're just, Cape Breton is ready because they are already so kind and compassionate and caring and supportive. And then the risk factor that was most surprising and most prevalent would almost seem like it's counterintuitive to the first. And it is the culture here is very, it's very supportive of the drinking culture, right? People celebrate here, kitchen parties, and, you know, it's all around, you know, let's have a beer together. And so there's a real culture here of acceptance of substance use, right? When we're specifically talking about alcohol, there is a real culture here that we have to work with, which we have to keep reminding ourselves that alcohol is not the enemy. It's addiction that's the enemy, right? And so it's not about the alcohol. It's about the addictive behaviors that go along with its accessibility, its acceptance as a cultural sort of norm to raise a glass, et cetera. And so those two things almost seem counterintuitive to one another, but I think they're going to work beautifully together as we, as a community, come together to try to, you know, come up with solutions to the problems that our youth are facing when it comes to substance use.
Den Hartog says the goal is that this becomes a community mindset and not just a temporary program.
We are not at all looking at this as a project or a program. This is something that we want to see happen in perpetuity, that this methodology is something that we adapt as Cape Bretoners, not just like at Undercurrent for a project for a 2.5 year funded cycle. And so there are so many factors involved in sustainability for us. I mean, we're trying to stay alive even just as Undercurrent Youth Society, the youth recreational center. I mean, we have that side of us and we have to fund that, and I have to pay my staff and, you know, all of that sort of thing. And so there's a sustainability factor involved in that. And then when it comes to this, when it comes to the Iceland prevention model, the sustainability really comes from the community. When the community buys in and when the community participates, that's what creates the sustainability. So it's not just the sustainability is not just in the money. The sustainability is really found within the people in the community who will involve themselves in the changing of the environment and in the adapting of this methodology in the areas of the environment that we can influence. I think we sell ourselves short sometimes on what we think we can and can't influence. Like, for instance, one of the things that we used to come up against is, so in Iceland, they implemented a curfew. And so at a certain time, youth between certain ages are not allowed to be on the streets. And one of the things that was told to us at the beginning of our conversations with community is, that'll never work here. We could never do that. And so therefore, that just sort of cancels out the possibility of doing the Iceland prevention model, right? But that's where the adaptability comes in. It's not about a curfew. It's about responding to the real needs here in our community. So maybe the curfew is not a good solution here. So what is then? And then, so you have the community voices being involved in deciding what it is that we can influence and the positive ways that we can change the environment. So it's not just about, again, taking this cookie cutter solution from another country and just like slapping it down and expecting it to work. We're really spending time in community so that community is a part of the development. So therefore, community is a part of the sustainability as well.
While the model is aimed at preventing youth substance use, Den Hartog says it doesn't see youth as the patient.
Society is the patient, and then the remedy or the cure or however you'd want to put it is sustained attention, right? So it's not about, okay, so now we've identified it and here's the solution and take care. We did it. Yay. It's now going to require sustained attention and also evaluation. And so we will do this data collection annually and we'll do the evaluation annually so that it doesn't turn into a project that starts and ends starts and fails. Or even succeeds and then ends, right? That sustainability is really already built in because of the sustained attention that community will give it.
You're listening to People First Radio. We've been hearing from Trevor Den Hartog, Executive Director of Undercurrent Youth Society in Glace Bay and New Waterford, Nova Scotia. His organization is taking an Icelandic model designed to prevent youth substance use and adapting it to a Cape Breton context. They're receiving federal funding for the task through the Public Health Agency of Canada's Youth Substance Use Prevention Program. There are a number of other groups across Canada who are also receiving funding to adapt the model to their own communities.
The cycle of poverty and the cycle of addiction, they work together. You know, there's no coincidence in that at all, because poverty and addiction are their bedfellows. And addiction and poverty keep folks in that cycle. And so when we're addressing those issues and those risk and protective factors that that are present here in the community, as we increase protective factors, then I think we're addressing both of those things, because when you have folks that are caught in that cycle of poverty and addiction, the only thing to get them out of that cycle is hope, right? And so one of the other things that we have been studying over the last couple of years and doing some research projects with Cape Breton University and some of their researchers and students is discovering what it is about hope, and not in the religious connotation, but in the real life connotation. When you ask a 13-year-old kid who has grown up in New Waterford how hopeful they are about the future, they don't really even know how to answer that question. They know what they know, and that's it. And so we really want to discover what it is that will increase hope and inspire hope, so that they can feel like there's something different than this cycle, and have something to look forward to in the future. Does that make sense? So it's not just about giving them opportunity, but it's also about a little bit of a mental shift and a mind shift when it comes to them embracing this idea that there is something out there for them. They have hope for the future. They can have something greater than they've known. They can experience things greater than they've experienced, or they can have more than their parents have had, or a better life, etc. You know, and I think myself, even as a parent, I think I want to give my kids a better life than I had. And I know my kids are going to want to give their kids a, right? And so it's sort of that that perpetual just wanting to do better. That's one of the things that I think has been identified as something that's missing. There is a real lack of hope in our kids here in Cape Breton.
Den Hartog says ultimately the goal is to make it easier for youth to make healthy choices.
Right now, if you had to sort of just sum it all up, the unhealthy choices are the default right now, because it's just easier. But what we want to see happen is that the healthy choices become the default, right? You know, making healthier choices about what you do with your leisure time. You know, so instead of, you know, going to the forest and having a beer with your friends when you're only 12 years old as the default, then maybe, you know, chess club or video game club or basketball or guitar lessons or whatever it might be, that will be your default choice. And I think that's where the hope comes from. Because right now, that's out of reach for a lot of our kids, because they just don't have the money. They don't have the resources to have those opportunities. So that's the missing piece.
Trevor Den Hartog is Executive Director of Undercurrent Youth Society in Cape Breton, Nova Scotia. He was speaking about adapting an Icelandic model aimed at preventing youth substance use to his local context.
People First Radio and Media are Vancouver Island Mental Health Society education and awareness programs.
On the other side of the continent from Cape Breton, the New Chanolth Youth Warrior Family Society are part of the same program, receiving federal support to adapt the Icelandic model to their local context. The Warriors already have a decade's worth of experience and success supporting youth, one weeknight a week, one weekend a month. In this next segment, we'll hear more about who they are and what they'll be able to adapt from the Icelandic prevention model.
U-u-k-ma, u-k-la-ma, Everett Watson, Histak-shisha, Sisha. Hello, everyone. My name is Everett Watson. I am Sishot First Nations. I grew up in the towns known as Port Alberni and in Ucluelet. I am the executive director of the Neutronless Youth Warrior Family Society. I'm so happy to be here chatting with you.
Hey, and I'm Ricardo. I'm a board member with the society that was started in 2023, just a couple of years ago. After running programming since 2015, we formed the society to kind of support with some of the background work that, you know, to help with programming on the land.
Well, thank you both very much for making some time to speak with me. Everett, could you give me a sense, first of all, of who the Neutronless Youth Warriors are and what you're all about?
Yeah, of course. So the Neutronless Youth Warriors are a number of groups of Indigenous youth along Neutronless territories, so the west coast of Vancouver Island, stretching from Nitnat in the south all the way up to Ihattis in the north. What we do is we help support land-based, youth-led programming in community, one weeknight a week, one weekend a month, getting the youth out in the land and reconnecting with their traditional territories. So guiding principles for our programming is to essentially provide, protect, and prepare. So provide for their community, protect their territories and natural resources, and prepare for emergencies. So everything from bushcraft, survivalcraft, to being able to build up food sovereignty initiatives and feel comfortable out in their traditional territories. A huge part of our work is trying to reconnect youth who are more and more becoming disconnected from our traditional territories with that land and building up that relationship and using modern tools to do so as well.
So what will the funding around the Icelandic prevention model allow the society to do?
This funding specifically allows us to create a multi-nation program in Port Alberni that's open to any Indigenous youth, and a women's program that's now running as well. So an Indigenous young person, any Indigenous young person in the Port Alberni area can attend now. In the past, it's been very difficult because the funding that we were able to get would flow through one nation or another nation. And, you know, there are youth that are from all the nations that wanted to join. And there's no way you can say no. But at the same time, politically, you know, people would get in like, hey, those kids aren't from here. And so there was a balance that we had to find. The easiest way was just to find the funding and raise our own funding to do it. We're so lucky that this worked to be able to find a way that we could fund it and also collect, you know, some of that data driven evidence that, island health and public health looks for.
One of the elements of the Icelandic prevention model is identifying risk and protective factors that exist for youth. I asked Dr. Ricardo Manmahan, who we just heard from, about what those factors look like for the youth the Warriors work with.
As far as protective factors and risk factors go, it's our approach has really been connecting with the youth over the last decade, and really driven by the youth voice. So, you know, we have such a varied understanding depending on the youth in each community. Having that close connection to an adult that's not a parent, we've found to be one of the most significant protective factors that we can provide within our programming. There's a lot more coming out as of this last symposium that we just went to or conference around the use of land-based approaches to programming. I kind of disagree with that word. I like activities better. It sounds a lot less weird. But the activities that we do and the ways that we're doing it. One of the ones that keeps coming up that I was very surprised by actually is online gambling. And we now have to create a whole new conversation to have with our young people as we drive places, as we work on the land together around that as well, because it turns out to be one of the growing challenges everywhere, including in Iceland. And so, yeah, I really feel like the protective factors that we're already using, that connection to healthy adults, that connection to land, and then also that influence of you know, having other things to do, as well as a lack of reception out on the land, they all contribute to minimizing that.
Watson shared some of the successes that the Warriors have seen from their work so far.
We can see that the program that we've done is successful because we see them moving forward and chasing their passions. We have youth that were a part of the program and still come out and still support the Warriors program, who are now going and revitalizing their traditional canoe families. We have them as language champions, working to reconnect the language and the culture, and doing some linguistic studies of the songs that is sang since childhood. We have youth that are going and doing building projects for other New Tolnoth nations, as well as creating connection across New Tolnoth. And so a lot of our feedback of the work we've been done that has been done to this point, we see in the success of the youth that have come through this program, and now they are taking those lessons going forward. There's one of the youth started as a front desk worker at a hotel, and now is fully qualified Red Seal and working with the local nation to help them with their building project and bring their people home. And so it's something that's been quite powerful for me to see. I've been away from community for a while, and I knew a lot of these youth growing up. But in the time span since I left and that now I've come back, to see the amount of growth and the amount of the fire in their bellies when they talk about these issues that they're passionate about and they're applying themselves to, and even knowing, like, I know a lot of the now young adults that were youth when I was growing up with them, and I know that they have struggled through really, really hard times. They've struggled through addiction and family issues, and this, our demographic is one of the hardest hit out here on the coast in terms of those societal factors. But seeing them push through and still work hard for their communities and have that role in their communities, quite a few of them are now working in their local First Nations governments in various aspects, helping lead their community. Stories and personal experiences are some of the densest forms of information transfer that there are out there. So yeah, how we measure success is largely from the youth that we've worked with and the communities that have come forward and kept supporting our programming going forward, and still do to this day.
This is People First Radio. The New Chanelth Youth Warrior Family Society helps facilitate land-based activities for Indigenous youth in and around Vancouver Island and coastal BC. Executive Director Everett Watson says that it's important to give youth real leadership roles and responsibilities to help them flourish.
Having youth lead the youth initiatives is so important, so huge. There's a lot of people in youth programming who think, okay, if I go and do all the back end and I go protect the youth from having to make decisions about these things. You know, it's my job as a youth worker to go out and find all the things to do and make the decisions and book the facilities and all this stuff. Is that will be successful. But you hear as well as with youth programming, if you don't have a youth voice in there leading, you could do a ton of amazing work and have a bunch of awesome programs set up. But if it's not what the youth in your area wants, then no one is going to show up. But I think one of the things we do in our organization is like center that youth voice. Our operations lead is one of the youth Each of the community leads have youth. And honestly, when I go to the local programs around Vancouver Island, I'm rarely the most knowledgeable person in the room about what the programming is that we're doing. I showed up to the seal harvesting workshop and I had never tasted seal. I don't know how to harvest it. I don't know how to gut it, clean it, skin it, anything like that. But that's not really my role. It's we're passing all these skills off to the youth. And it may seem counterintuitive, but by giving the youth access to roles where they're able to do the planning and able to do the leadership and really guide what me and Ricardo do, in terms of, okay, what do they want us to go and find money for to fund? That's a huge part of the success of our program. And that's a huge part that I think a lot of youth programs are missing is having youth in the driver's seat. And like, as the adults with the titles and access to resources, really our role is to facilitate those youth to, like, yeah, don't have them do all the work, but you need to meaningfully engage them and build up their skills so that they can carry it on. Because at the end of the day, we're only around for so long, and it's going to be the youth that are end up going to be taking our roles. It's youth. Like, we already are thinking a few generations ahead of who the next executive director will be in 10 to 15 years, and we've got lots of potential among the youth warriors. And by shielding them from those leadership decisions, you're really just handicapping them in the future.
I asked Watson about the idea of society as the patient in a youth substance use prevention model.
Yeah, it's completely true. I mean, if you look at, anyone who speaks of upstream downstream models, well, what's the source of that spring? What's at the top of the mountain? And at the end of the day, that is society. There are systemic and societal factors that are driving youth into harmful spaces. It's affecting our mental health, it's affecting our physical well-being, and affecting our desire to want to seek other methods of getting dopamine and things. So at the end of the day, society is what needs to change if we're going to. It's like if you look at Iceland and how they implemented it there, they invested heavily into infrastructure. They built recreation centers right next to their schools. They went through changes of government. They, if you don't have secure housing, the cost of living is way too high. There's systemic discrimination. There's race-based inequity. All of those things are things that you're going to have to solve if you're going to want to make a meaningful and lasting difference to health for everyone, not just youth. So, one of the things you need to think of is when you're doing this programming, are you modeling that society that will be required to make that change going forward? I like to use the analogy of paddling in a canoe upstream, sort of a traditional story in New Chalmers. We believe the salmon are people. They live in a longhouse under the sea, and every season they paddle their canoes, which are their salmon's bodies, up the river, and they get upstream. And in this generation, we're only going to be able to paddle this canoe so far. So we need to be training that next generation of paddlers to n take that next hop higher, because focusing on it as a youth programming only is going to solve youth substance use issues is naive. There's going to be a lot of different things we're going to have to tackle going forward to make a meaningful difference in this. And so, yeah, we approach it from a holistic perspective. Hey, are we equipping the youth to be able to thrive in the world going forward? They'll be comfortable no matter where they are. Even if they're in the middle of the woods, they know that they'll at least be able to survive or at least tough it out until they get somewhere that they're safe. But giving them those roles and responsibilities so that they. That's why we're the New Chalmers Youth Warrior Family Society. We're a family. And we're a society. We're building that society that we need to model going forward. And we're seeing our youth going and taking that those roles in community after they leave young adulthood, and they carry that into their 20s and then into their 30s. And I think it's an important thing to keep in mind is that if you just think of it as youth programming, you're going to miss the mark.
Watson says the work the Warriors have been doing for a decade overlaps with many of the tenets of the Icelandic prevention model.
Learning what we can from these models and learning what we can from all the different implementations and keeping our mind open to seeing what's working around you. And at the end of the day, like this data-driven approach, our eyes and our ears are some of the best forms of data collection. So if you are doing youth programming wherever, any way engaging with youth and youth programming, if you maintain that mindfulness of watching the youth and understanding and seeing what they want to do, and your feedback all comes just through observation, if that's something that you foster. And so with the IPM, gives us a new lens to look at our own programming, ways to improve it, and ways that we need to focus on other areas. We also bring our own perspective, and we bring a bit of that new Chalmers touch to it, because at the end of the day, many of these models and frameworks already exist in traditional indigenous pedagogy. But that's something that has been eroded over time. And so, you know, we're here trying to reconnect to those roots and use whatever tool that we can to reach the youth that need this kind of programming the most.
It was Everett Watson, Executive Director of the Nuchanoth Youth Warrior Family Society. That's it for the show today. You've been listening to People First Radio. I'm Joe Pugh. Thanks so much for tuning in. I hope you can join me again next week.
People First Radio is a community media project of Vancouver Island Mental Health Society and produced in Nanaimo, British Columbia. The opinions expressed do not necessarily represent the views of Vancouver Island Mental Health Society or its broadcast partners.